Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Terry Ogburn is the owner of Ogburn's Business Solutions. He has developed a business development process that helps entrepreneurs and business owners learn the importance of working on your business instead of being caught up in the day-to-day grind. His unique system and personal devotion to the development of others has contributed to the success of hundreds of small to large business ventures. Terry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Sam, and thanks again for having me on your show. I appreciate it very much.
The pleasure's all mine. Can you quickly give our listeners just a brief background of where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
It's an interesting story. I was fired out of the car business. I was a salesperson working in the car industry in the 70s, and so I wanted to move forward in life. They had other ideas, so I was number one and considered in the top five anyway. And so I started an air conditioning business. There was just no car, no truck. There was a broken duct I could fix and just a little enterprising thing to keep me some money. And we got to remember my rent was $135 a month. My electric bill was $35 a month. My phone was $25. So there was not a lot of expenses. Had about $118 left. And so I decided that I could get this started. Well, I started running into people. I started getting mentors and people saying, well, listen, I do it this way and I do it this way. And I learned all the things that you shouldn't do. I mean, I did everything wrong that you could possibly do. But at the same time, I kept striving forward. I just kept moving forward. And then I adapted some books into my life. I got into Think and Grow Rich and The E-Myth and some other books. And I put together a system that actually caused my air conditioning business to run for 10 years. And I sold it to the employees. So that was a good testimony, 10-year business, plus sell it to your employees. You've created something that was really good. And then I got in corporate America and started putting my systems and processes into the corporate arena. I took a company public. I was one of five people that sat down at a kitchen table, so to speak. And we did this thing in 2.5 years. IPO went out. We invested $5 million. We walked away with 13. I didn't get a lion's share of that, but I was part of the learning process. And that was the valuable, was learning how all this process goes, you know? And so then I just took my product on the road, did some turnaround stores for Radio Shack, Metrocall Paging, AT&T Wireless, some of the big companies. And about 15 years ago, I decided to, when the downturn in real estate happened, I just spent 6 years in the real estate world with Century 21 doing some turnaround stores for them. And that took a downturn in 2005, 2006, you probably remember. So I thought, well, this would be a great time to jump in and help small businesses. So I just re-geared, just changed directions as we have to do in business and geared up and started helping small businesses turn around, do my thing, same things I've been doing all along. But now for the small guy, I felt it would be the little guys that turn this country around.
That's interesting. So you've got to see kind of front row for a lot of different types of businesses, how they turned around their business, what they did to optimize, what they did to cut fat, what they did to improve operations.
The thing is that everybody thinks their situation is unique, but it really isn't. When you get down into the core of what's going wrong, it's just a few basic things like organizational charts, who reports to who. Like I'm working with one of the largest boat companies in America, and we're now retooling their way they're doing their training. They're now starting to train against their job descriptions, not what the ideal position, but what are they supposed to be doing when they're doing at their job? Because most people are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're doing somebody else's job. One of the things I learned quick in business was if you wanted to fire somebody, all you had to do is ask them to do their job and they'd quit.
That's interesting. When you say organizational charts, what does that mean? Are you saying that every organization just have a printed wall chart with what the positions are? What does that even mean?
Exactly, Sam. Even with people with small businesses, it may take 14, 15 positions to run your company and you're all by yourself. You got to pay bills.
Sure.
You got to collect your money. Well, there's accounts receivable and accounts payable right there that's already in your hat of all the other hats that you wear, marketing, marketing coordinator, marketing design. I mean, so there's a lot of facets that go into business. So it's all out there on the line. You just go out there, figure out what it is you want to do in marketing. make out a job description for that part of your business. If there's two of you, you divide it up. But yeah, every business, I don't care how big or small. I've walked into companies and they say, oh, well, Terry, we're too small to have an organizational chart. I said, well, you have accounts payable. And these are all just basic things you have to do. We have to understand those positions too.
What does it benefit? And let's shift a little bit in thinking, since now the bulk of your business is towards the small entrepreneur or small company. What is the benefit of starting with an org chart and saying, okay, this is what these positions are?
Well, it helps you create checklists so that you can, so once you understand the responsibility, if you say make out checks, and you can form a checklist to help you do that. Well, the more checklists you have, the easier your job goes, right? I mean, if you don't have to pull out all the stuff, if you know you got to pull this out, you get it all together. Well, anytime that we can put something in a system or a recipe or whatever, McDonald's, think of it this way. McDonald's hires 18 to 22 year old kids. They have 300% turnover rate in every one of their restaurants, yet they're the most profitable franchise out there. They do it because they put systems in place that 18 to 22-year-old people can follow that don't have to take a lot of thinking. So the more we can duplicate that, the more we can put these things in processes and pieces of paper, then if we need help, we can say, hey, nephew, come over here. Do these five things here for me. I'm busy right now. Can you just follow these checklists and get them done? It's organization. It's about getting yourself to an organized mindset so that you're free to be creative. You can think rather than being bogged down in the day-to-day minutiae.
Right. Oh, gosh. And you said it. I don't know anybody who is, say, under five employees, even 10 employees, who still isn't bogged down in the day-to-day minutiae and isn't fighting like mad to get out of it. So it sounds like that's step one, is figure out what those positions are so that you can put the right seats on the bus for people in the right seats on the bus. Is that right?
Exactly. When I go into a company, the first thing I do is say, let me see your organizational chart and your job descriptions, because I got to find out what you're supposed to be doing or how can I hold you accountable?
Right.
And who do you report to? And how can I do? I need to stream. Maybe you're reporting to the wrong person.
Sure. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. What's your next step? When you look at a business and you try to find out what's wrong or what could be improved, what's your next step then?
We need a culture. A lot of times you'll have people with different ideas in your company. You have this person's thought and you use that. Well, you've created this culture. Well, now that has to be explained to everybody that's coming on board in the future. Or if you're going to be replacing people, you bring in outside people. Well, we've been doing it this way for 25 years. Why do I have to change? Well, you come into a new culture. So I did some work for a bank up in Iowa, and they merged two different bank communities together, and they could not send a person from one branch to another because they didn't do it the same way. So, I mean, you think you're doing good, but you're not. So once you understand the core values, how the people think, I have a set of core values that I ask everybody to adapt to, so to speak. It's about integrity and how you feel about the customer. Another thing that I give your listeners is I ask the people I work with to write a letter. I want you to write a letter. Think of this. I want you to write as if it's coming from a customer, and it explains their entire encounter from the time they interacted with you till the product was delivered. This is a testimony of how well your service, how well they were handled through the website, how well they were handled at this reception area, whatever it was. Detail it so precise, then read that to your employees and they're going to be in awe. And you say, now we got to live up to this. That becomes our mission statement. That becomes what we're in business for.
That's really smart. That's a lot easier, I would think, to do that exercise than it is to sit down and go, all right, so what core values do we, I mean, that just sounds like a bland and boring exercise. Like, let's find big words in the dictionary that might mean something to us, put them on a wall and say, this is what we stand for. Like, beat me senseless, but give me the opportunity to write what I would like my experience to be if I were a customer.
And you get two or three of your employees to write that. Man, you got some powerful words there that you can get your people to live up to. And this person saying, oh, I contributed and I contributed. It's a well thing. And then new people coming in, they don't have any choice but to follow your onboarding process, which is another thing that I think good businesses would have is an onboarding process. Most of the companies, when a new person comes on board, and I think you would agree with me, that employee stands around for a couple of days trying to figure out what to do.
Right.
So let's bring them on board. Like with Radio Shack, for an example, we had a pre-onboarding process. So we created a process that a new associate before they could ever come home to the floor had to mystery shop six of our stores. So they had to go and buy three items and then return those three items. And then they had a checklist that they went by. Did he have his tie on? Did he have, was he dressed appropriate? Did he have his name badge? All these things that we drilled into their head, what to look for, whether it was wrong, so that when they got on the floor, they made sure that they looked right.
That's really smart. I like that. I like that idea a lot. Let's go back to culture. We started talking about that. And of course, in these conversations, we go a little bit all over the place, which is great. I love it. But we talked about how defining maybe core values, and maybe I just missed it, but how does one create and bring people into culture? How did you rectify the situation with the two banks and their competing cultures?
You get people to adapt to one philosophy. So I think everybody would agree to integrity.
Sure.
Okay. So that becomes a core value. We are a team filled with integrity, how we care for the customer. So the common sense ones is easy. Now, the hard part is teaching them to live by that.
Right.
Because the core values are not supposed to be spoken by us. And you'll see that in a lot of companies. That's their ego. They're, oh, well, we want the customer to speak of our core values. Oh, that's a great company. They're customer service oriented. Oh, that's a great team of people. They all work together. You want to develop that culture within you that people are saying those things about you. So walking the walk, and then you can ask people to walk the walk with you. But it's all about perception.
That's very, very interesting. And maybe I missed it. You said with those two banks, you had to find one that they had to adhere to. How did you do that without having warfare on your hands?
Well, again, there's casualties. And one of my statements is you ride the horses you have until you get better horses. Okay. It's not easy to blend cultures. I'm not trying to say I'm a master at it. I'm saying that you have to do it. Okay. But that may mean that you move people in the right roles and maybe their personality is not in the right role. You get a lot of disgruntled people. So again, the idea is getting everybody to buy into the logical, common sense culture that everybody, they want everybody to speak about. Like I had in the bank industry, the lady wore customer service. That was her title. It was on her shirt. And I said, well, one of the things I would do if I was you is I would change the script when the customer came to the counter. The new culture would be, how may I serve you today? It says customer service, and how may I serve you is a good way of adapting. And she said, oh, no, I only serve God. She didn't want to change the script. It wasn't the word. She didn't want to change her script the way she wanted to do it. So these people have to be brought into line through either incentivizing them, get them to paint a picture of how they're going to, it's going to grow the company, how by changing these little things about us, we can get more customers. You can cross train. That means you can take one thing. You can take this person out of this bank and move them over to another bank. So you point out the benefits and the change. People don't like change. And I think you would agree with me. Okay. So in changing cultures and making things adaptable and creating one culture to come by, there's going to be change. So if we don't show benefit in the change, then we're going to have opposition.
Yeah.
So we have to tell the clients all the time, if I'm about to make a change, make sure I understand how many of people are going to be affected with that change. And that affects the culture as well. If you're not thinking about who all this is going to affect, then all that work you put in for core values is blown out the window because they don't care about me. They can't care about the customer. You ever walked into a store and be treated badly?
Sure.
Well, then you know it's not the person treating you badly. It's the management treating the person badly that is stemming down from the way they're being treated. That's how we behave, human behavior.
That's wild. Yeah, those are things you don't think about. And I can, gosh, you're convicting me because I'm going back to a business we bought a few years ago. And I probably went in like a bull in a china shop and just said, hey, here's what we're doing with no buy-in, and certainly got a lot of blowback.
Yeah. Like when I would go in, and I didn't mean to step on you there, but when I would go in, I didn't do anything for 2 weeks. I just sit around, take notes, walk around writing things down. People afraid. Then I'd call everybody together and I'd fire them. That's what they've been sitting on pins and needles about anyway. So, okay, but the good news is you're all rehired at new positions. Here's your new positions. You're now not the receptionist, you're the administrative assistant. People like to be promoted. They don't like their title, so give them a title that with more grandeur. That gets them at least started off in a different direction. And then if they don't want to conform to your new culture, then you, again, find people that will.
Right. Yeah. And you're doing a good job of breaking this down. It's difficult, but I think it's more difficult not doing what you're saying.
Well, actually, it's easier to do what I'm asking you not to do. It's easier to do it that way. That's why 50% of the businesses fail the first year and 80% of the businesses are going to fail in the first 3 years because they don't take the time to do their due diligence. There is no reason for any business not to be successful. There's too many people out there that are successful for us just to follow. Like, for an example, you follow McDonald's, you can't lose if you follow their pattern.
Right.
But, oh, I got to do it my way. That's your ego. Right. So the ego is based on fear, the fear that you're not going to be respected as the boss. You're not going to, your commissions are going to go away. Any person that ever's got anything, and then they look at ego, if they become egotistical about whatever their accomplishments are, they're afraid that that's going to go away.
Mm. Yeah. Or they're afraid that if they don't do it their way, that the results will be inferior.
But that's where the micromanaging comes in, because I can only do it. I'm the guy that can fix this. I've worked with many companies where the boss would let the thing get all out of whack and then swoop in and be the savior.
How do you correct that?
That's a hard one. Let me tell you, that is not easy, because he is the savior. He's been doing it for 15 years, so to speak. So it's through empowerment, learning how to empower people to make mistakes. We want our team to make mistakes. We want them to not get it, so to speak. We wanted them to come up with ideas. So if you're in the trenches and you make a mistake, it's far more likely you're going to try to figure that mistake out than come running to me. If you come running to me, then I'm going to send you back, go get two solutions and come back to me. But you're going to try to get yourself fixed. You're going to try to fix it. And sometimes that creative idea can help you out. One of the questions I ask in the interviewing process in my air conditioning days was, are you lucky? And the guy would look at me and go, what do you mean, am I lucky? And I said, well, are you lucky or are you an unlucky person? He goes, well, I guess I'm lucky. Yeah. He goes, why do you ask? And I said, because when you're 45 miles away from here, I don't need to send a truck out to help you. I need you to be able to figure out what's wrong and get it fixed. So it's lucky is harder you work. So that's what I'm really looking for. It's no real luck in this world. It's somebody's going to work themselves out of the problem they developed or fell into, so to speak.
Right. What are some of the other interview questions that you ask when you're onboarding a client that really give you a view into what the situation is?
One of them is, why should I hire you?
You're talking about for an employee?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I was going there. If you're wanting to come on board with me, if one of the ending questions would be, why should I hire you?
Right. Yeah. Great question.
And then the other one is, why do you want to work for me?
Two very good questions. And I'm sure that presents all sorts of information.
Well, it's shocking because they're never expecting to have to answer that. Another thing that I do in the onboarding process is I give them homework. So between the first interview and the second interview, they have to go to my website and find out three things that they like about it and three things they don't like about it.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I mean, that gives you good critical feedback right away.
And if they're going to follow instructions, it tells me that later on in life, they may follow what I asked them to do.
That's brilliant. The question I was actually, which I think those are great points to make on the hiring side of things. When you're dealing with a client coming to work with you as a consultant, what are some of the questions? Like, say I came to work with you, Terry, and you'd said, hey, Sam, all right, let's find out more about your business. What are some of the things that you ask us as clients coming to work with you that kind of shed light on where we are and how you can help us?
What I try to get a feel for first is, what is your paradigm? What is it you see? Where do you see yourself 5 years from now? So first I have to discern whether that this is a pipe dream or is it something that we can really put together? We got something to work with here. I ask if you're coachable. Mm. It's a big question to me. In the beginning of it, the first question I would ask you is, what are the three outcomes of this meeting that you're looking for? So now I get a good picture. Then I just make sure that I answer those questions through the different questions that I would ask that may come up. I've got a list. If you don't mind me reaching in my drawer, I could come up with them real quick.
Let's do it. Because I think those are fascinating things that would present would give us some insight into the types of problems that you see. I know we talked about several of your first steps, organizational charts, the onboarding process, culture. We talked about assigning core values and how some of those things occur. But I think it's also interesting from your side of the desk, what your probing questions are and what those probing questions tell you as you hear the answers.
Okay. Here's my list. I'll show it to you. Here's my intake form, so to speak. What are the three outcomes that you'd like to accomplish at this meeting? How will you know if this meeting has been successful, besides the fact that I answer the questions that I just asked? Please give me a brief description of your business.
Yeah.
Okay. So now I've got a good framework of what this meeting is going to be about from your paradigm. See, I have to adjust my paradigm now to yours.
Right.
Now, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. We're going to go really quick through these, and they're just yes or no. That would be how I would deliver the script. I say, okay, do you have a business plan? Do you have a strategic plan, an action plan, how you're going to implement your business plan? Do you have an operations manual? This is a whole manual that handles your business if you're not there. Do you have a budget or performa? Do you know what a performa is? Performa is a forecast of income versus expenses for the next 3, 6, 9 months, year out, so that you can plan a stage growth for your business.
Gotcha.
So you can see by just asking some of these questions, it automatically tells me how in tune you are with the business. And then if you have a business plan, then I don't have to talk about that. If you have an action plan, I don't have to talk about that. So if you're not sure about what a budget or performer is, and you don't have job descriptions, you don't have a time management system, and I'm just going through the rest of them, then I know what to pinpoint, what to go after. Now, you got to remember, I've now set us up for me, so to speak, in attack mode.
Right.
Right. So I'm coming back at that way. So then I shift gears. Is this good?
No, this is good. I like this because this does paint a good picture. Keep going.
So what is your biggest challenge that you see in front of you right now? So I start asking more feel good questions, making you feel good. What key improvements do you see in your business? What is the single biggest revenue generator that you have for your business? What significant thing that must happen in the next 90 days that would be beneficial to you? What are you passionate about your business? Do you have specific out of the ordinary goals for your business?
And those are all things that you would think that we would have nailed down.
Exactly.
But I would bet that obviously people come to you because they don't have these things nailed down. Why is it that you find that these are sometimes the hardest parts of business and especially entrepreneurs to get them to nail down?
Because somebody along their life said, you know, you'd make a good podcaster, or you'd make a good cook, or you'd make a good this, or you'd make a good that. People think because they're good at technical work that they're going to be good at business. And running a business has nothing to do with technical work. When I come in with a business, the first thing they'll tell me, yeah, but Terry, you don't understand my business. You're right. I don't understand podcasting. I wouldn't even give it a clue how to make that work as a business. However, there's the technical part of it. But if you want to know how to set your business up to make a profit, I'm your guy.
Right. I forget what's one of the major authors, but they said that it's a technician having an entrepreneurial seizure.
That's Michael Gerber in the E-Myth. And his whole book is based on the study of McDonald's.
Right.
If you study McDonald's, you just follow their principles. I mean, it's that simple, but they have a university. I don't know if you know this, but they have a school that everybody is trained through their university. You use their employment contracts. You use their bank. You use their financial institutions. You use their lawyers because they're tired of fighting with all these other people. You do it this way, we're going to be successful. And if you're not, they have a crew ready to swoop in and get that restaurant so it doesn't fail.
Yeah, they have the emergency chute already built in, I'm sure, to their contracts where they can get you out.
Because they can't report it in their document, because if they reported it, if they have a failure, then it makes their business less profitable. So they have to come in and make sure that they don't have to report anything negative.
Right. What are some of the, I guess, the greatest turnaround, maybe give us a turnaround story, where you've worked with somebody that was not in a good spot and you were able to, in however long it took, to get them to somewhere they never thought was possible?
It was my first Radio Shack store. This was my worst scenario, so to speak. You come in, they're already failing. All right. So this is Radio Shack. This is not on the manager, although he gets the blunt of the problem. He's not making a profit. Now, they set this store up in the middle of called Margate, Florida. Now, it's a little town that's bordered by two other towns, Coconut Creek and Terramar. Now, the average age, Sam, in this three communities is 77 years old. So they plop down a technical store, a Radio Shack, right in the middle of a 77-year-old community. And they wondered, it wasn't brilliant on their location, right? So I was sent in. So the second day I'm there, the manager, we're standing out there looking, store observing, and these little buses pull up, the little guys with the walkers and the canes and stuff, and they start migrating towards the store. And the manager comes up and says, look, it's the night of the living dead. And I said, well, I can fix this store right now. And he said, how? And I said, well, change your attitude. I said, those people chose to come here today, so let's make it enjoyable. So let's go down to the bagel shop. Let's get some bagels and some coffee and some cream cheese and stuff. And we know they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so let's have a little spread for them. Then we trained the associates that when there were trouble with their electronics, then offer to take that, go with them and install it at their house on the way home. And so I started the president. So you'd come in, you were a little skittish. I said, well, look, don't worry, Sam, I'll come by your house tonight on the way. Oh, no, don't. It's on my way home. Everything was on my way home. So I just stopped by for a few minutes, program it, hang it on the wall, get their voicemail set up for them, get it all programmed for them. And I was leaving with $5. Now, not that I went there for the money, but it was just these people were so happy. Well, that news spread. Those people started migrating to our store. They started coming over. And I'll just end with this story. So I'm handling this guy. He's 82 years old. He was the actual guy in the ring with Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. He was the boxer. Well, I set him up with a wireless headset, and so his wife could sleep and he could enjoy the TV at night or whatever their little deal was. Well, he turns out to be best friends with the chairman of the company. So I get a handwritten letter. The manager and I get this letter stating how great the service was, all the way from the chairman of the board in his 82-year-old handwriting all the way down. So you just don't know who you're talking to as well. So giving customer service is the point to the question, is giving back to the community, finding out what you can do. Like when I was in the air conditioning business, if you called me out to your house before my team left, your unit was waxed. All the screws were put in the unit, brand new screws, all shiny brand new screws were back in the unit. It was waxed and the grass was all clipped around the slab that it sits on. Well, you come home from work, you're expecting a sloppy mess out there, whatever. You walk around and it's like, wow. So we need to create the wow factor in all of our business. And we can, like Marine Max, the company I work for, they have fan scores. They actually send out surveys. We all do that, feedback. But you got to hold them accountable. You can't just get the feedback. Hold the people accountable to get those scores up.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I love that in creating the wow factor in the customer. This has been a great conversation, Terry. Thank you for taking the time really to break down how it is that you see business, the things that you ask people, that gives you insight into how those businesses are functioning, and then how that crafts for you the story or the processes that you need to help entrepreneurs implement in order to take their business to the next level.
It's common sense stuff. It's just little things that we just letting slip through our fingers, so to speak. I don't have any magic bullets. You know that. I mean, you've heard all this stuff before. It's just that we lose touch sometimes with just the simple stuff. We try to make it easy. And first we should make it simple. Then it will be easy.
That's great. I love that line. Make it simple. Then it will be easy. Yeah. And that's it. And these things take time. And it always feels like there's never enough time to spend to get it done the right way, or at least the way that you're going to teach people how to do. So
one of the things I would tell my guys in the air conditioning unit, if we don't have time to do it right the first time, how do we have time to go back?
Right. When are we going to have time to do it right again? Terry, I've enjoyed it. Let's jump here to the final four questions. They're real estate related questions. So I know you're not necessarily in the real estate business, but that's okay. They're the same four questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. And so maybe you'll give us a new perspective today. So here it goes. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Tax liens or tax deeds? Because of the things that we're going through right now, I can only imagine that some of our counties are ending up with properties that people aren't paying their taxes. We can step in and pay the taxes and generate some income for our money, so to speak, and help the communities by making sure the fire and the police and all these things are that we need are still there. So look into the communities and see what help you can make from just paying somebody's tax bill, and you'll get your money back.
Right. Yeah, that's great. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I think a lot of real estate investors don't understand this principle, and that is it's not how to get into a property, it's how you get out of the deal. So make sure that we understand the exiting strategy before we ever get into the deal and make sure we have a clear path of how to get out.
Yeah, man, you said it. The exit is way more important than the entrance. So that's awesome. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
I don't know if it's making the world a better place, but I think it would make the world a better place if everybody did it. And that is invest in gold and silver and real estate. My portfolio has been this since the mid 80s. Gold, precious metals, coins, and real estate. We can never go wrong. When there's a downturn, we know to bail, we figure out. But when you're dealing with gold and precious metals and coins and silver certificates and things like that, it's just always going to increase.
Right. Yeah, I love that. Terry, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you, get your book, anything else you'd like to share, how would they do that?
You can go to terryogburn.com. I have a free ebook there that will get you, help you understand about quarterly planning and strategic thinking like that. I'm also willing to give your listeners 1 hour of my time, no charge. Simply go to my website, terryogburn.com, click on the appointments section, and then schedule an hour with me. We'll discuss a challenge, anything that you may have. No sales pitch. It's not a pitch at any way. It's just, let's get some help out there for these people who maybe this pandemic is not helping them so much. So I'll be glad to share any of my knowledge with them. No charge whatsoever.
That's Terry Ogburn, TerryOgburn.com for those of you who are listening. Terry, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
I appreciate you too, Sam. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.